So I think the reason he thought me well qualified to talk about not turning away from yourself is because I have a history of chronic pain and I've trained as a breathworks teacher. Now, at a guess, probably many of you don't know what Breathworks is. It's an organisation that was founded by three order members in the UK, Vijayamala, Sona and Ratnaguna, although at this stage it's technically a secular group. And it aims to teach people how to manage chronic pain and improve their quality of life through mindfulness and self-compassion practice. So I will reference Breathworks and particularly Vijayamala quite a lot during this talk because it's been such a big part of my practice and it's so rooted in the principle of not turning away from ourselves. So if I don't talk about practices like Tonglen, which I won't, it's not because they're not valid or valuable, it's just that I have no particular experience of them. But it seems to me that however you manifest the practice of turning towards yourself, the heart of the practice is the same. So most of us instinctively run away from pain, emotional or physical. So this practice of not turning away can seem quite counterintuitive, perhaps a bit self-punishing, or just really, really hard. The practice itself, I think, is quite simple and beautiful. What's hard is the aversion, resistance, and fear that we have around turning towards our experience. So we might fear that by really letting in our pain, it will overwhelm us and we won't be able to cope. We might fear that by really letting in joy, we only invite pain for ourselves when that joy subsides. We might fear the identity we attach to the parts of us that are petty, envious, or angry. And we might think this makes us a horrible person, full stop, end of story. But part of that fear and resistance is rooted in our own ignorance and seeing things as fixed and controllable. We don't really understand in our hearts that all conditioned things are impermanent, and many of the conditions that cause situations to arise and fall away are outside our control, like weather and other people. So we might think nothing good ever happens to me, or nothing bad can ever happen to me. We don't want the good things to end, and we don't want the bad things to happen. But life is a continual flux of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, and in between. And we are a continual flux of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, and in between. And we really only have control over how we respond to any experience as it arises. In Breathworks, we use the image of a dinghy being thrown about from wave to wave in a stormy sea to describe our life when we're trying to resist and control our experience, specifically our physical pain. And this resistance and control can take many forms, drowning in our sorrows, throwing ourselves into work, following strict diet and exercise regimes, drinking, but they're all done with a particular goal, which is to push away our experience. We have no stability, no perspective, and are really just being constantly buffeted about, and it's exhausting. As Dharma practitioners, we might think in terms of the worldly winds, being buffeted about by pleasure and pain, praise and blame, fame and infamy, loss and gain. The alternative image is that of a big streamlined yacht with ballast for depth and stability, and a tall mast to look out above the surface waves of pleasure and pain with a broader perspective. If we could see the whole ocean, we'd know there are stormy patches, calm patches, and everything in between. And we would see that they are all in a constant flow. The way to cultivate stability and a deeper sense of happiness in a world of impermanence is to stop resisting our experience and chasing after something better and equally impermanent, and to start turning towards our experience instead. Most of us will only do this when we've been running away for a long time and are starting to see that it doesn't work. Everywhere we run to, there we are. Death is inescapable. Everything is impermanent and thus flavoured with unsatisfactoriness. And in terms of people who sign up for a Breathworks course, they're usually at the end of the road medically. Are alternative practitioners out and are no longer successfully convincing themselves that they're fine. And I don't mean that in a harsh way, but just from shared experience, because it's what most of us are like. On some level, we all realise that we have to approach our predicament differently. Well, really, we just have to approach our predicament. I was messaging with a group of Breathworks teachers and trainees a couple of years ago, and someone who had just had some pretty full-on spinal surgery asked if anyone had any tips on how to commit themselves to pacing when sitting at the computer. And pacing, although I think we try to jazz it up as something like mindfulness of daily life these days, is part of the Breathworks program. And he had a timer set for something like 20 minutes, because if he sat too long, it spiked his pain levels. But he was getting really frustrated at having to interrupt his work and take breaks so often. And my response to him was that the practice was both very simple and very difficult. Every time the timer goes off is a moment of choice. In that moment, we can turn towards our present experience with honesty, accept how we are in that moment, reflect on how we want to treat ourselves and perhaps those around us, and respond in a wise way. Or we can react to the frustration, keep working, and deal with the inevitable fallout later. Every time something painful arises in our experience and we feel ourselves wanting to do a runner is like the timer going off. We have a choice to align ourselves with our values and try to respond creatively and wisely, or just react habitually. It takes a lot of courage to do something different. We have to be willing to let go of the illusion of control, of attaching to a particular outcome or identity. And we have to be willing to allow ourselves to experience, not rationalise, but actually experience pain. It's a great paradox that some of the greatest moments of peace and joy I have experienced have occurred when I have surrendered to pain, both emotional and physical. Just completely accepted it and let go in that moment, because there was really nothing else to do. It's like if I give up the struggle to find rhyme or reason in it, in that moment, it just is. And I find it quite hard to put language around that experience. There is a softening and a peace and a beauty in surrender. Life suddenly seems precious. And I see this in people on Breathworks courses and also on mindfulness-based stress reduction courses, that they find this hidden gem in turning towards their experience. It's something that each of us has to practice and realise for ourselves. That there's this lovely little poem by David White that kind of expresses something of it for me. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. So to me, that poem points at the preciousness we uncover when we really open to life, just as it is right now, without question of why it is, projections about what it means, or for us to be more or have more than we are right now. Just this moment, even if it's not the moment we wanted. But how do we do this when our instinct is to run from pain? In Breathworks courses, when people are in chronic physical pain, we ask them to do something very brave and to gently open to their experience of pain with an attitude of tenderness and kindness, to breathe with it for a while, then begin to explore the physical sensations of pain more precisely and as much as possible without judgment, by which I mean without attaching any particular meaning or significance to the sensations, because those kind of thoughts and emotions will come up. In doing this, they often discover their pain is less solid and fixed than they think, or more centred in one particular area than they thought. For some, initially, the pain seems worse than they thought. This is often because they've been so adept at blocking it out. And that's certainly my experience when I go through times when I have to just get through something at work and I just block my body out, really. Over time, I just started to expand the breathworks practice to turn towards mental and emotional pain as well. And I do this by bringing it into the body. It's really just because it was a practice that I knew. So, for example, if I feel scared, I look for areas of tightness or resistance in my body. Fear often manifests as tension in my chest and stomach. And if I breathe into it with gentleness and kindness, sometimes it very quickly dissipates. Sometimes just bringing awareness to the physical sensation itself is enough for things to soften. Loneliness might manifest as sensations around the heart. It can be different for everybody, but we can work with emotions through working on the physical manifestation of them in our bodies. And it's also a really nice way of making it a little easier to drop the story or analysis and the charge that our minds like to race away with if we stay more in our heads. So it's not always an easy practice. If we notice really strong fear arising around turning towards something difficult, whatever that might be, the instruction is to breathe with the fear, with tenderness and kindness, and to just stay with that as long as you need to. If we just feel really resistant towards our difficulty, we use a visual metaphor. In breathworks, it tended to be a bale of hay, but we had a few farm-type people who pointed out that would be a pretty scratchy thing to have to lean into. So I'm going with a mattress leaning against a wall. And you imagine that your resistance is like that mattress leaning against a wall. The mattress appears solid and firm, but as you lean into it, you find it actually has some give and softness around the edges. Perhaps you can sense your resistance softening in the same way as you imaginatively lean into it in your experience. And if it continues to just feel really hard and stuck, then we just breathe with the resistance, with tenderness and kindness. So it's not a brutal, I must confront my fears, head-on approach. We work with what's really arising for us in each moment. We meet it with a tender and kind attitude, and we try to be patient with ourselves. If we're overwhelmed by fear or pain or aversion, we broaden our focus and actively seek out small, pleasant aspects of our present experience, like a feeling of warmth somewhere in the body, a pleasant sound or smell or sight. It might be the sun lighting up the dew on a spider's web, the smell of fresh coffee or bread, or the feel of sunlight against our cheek. There is always more to our experience than we think, and there is almost always something pleasant, as well as whatever unpleasant aspect we are struggling with. On the other hand, if we find ourselves actually feeling quite blocked or numb, we need to move closer to our experience, look for more detail, lean into it a little bit more. But we might also just need to let go of the subtle or not so subtle desire for things to change right now. There's a sort of gist of a quote that I recall, and I can't remember where I came across it, so I couldn't find it accurately. But it's something like, to open the heart takes a feather, not a sledgehammer. So we turn to meet ourselves as gently as a floating feather coming to rest on our hearts. Over time, many people, including myself, find that their chronic pain generally appears to reduce through this practice of compassionate acceptance and just general daily mindfulness, which is the opposite of what we all tend to fear, which is that it will be overwhelming and we won't be able to cope. When we talk about it, we can't actually tell whether our physical pain has objectively changed or whether our relationship to it has changed over time. That our awareness has expanded out to include more than our pain, that we're coming to appreciate the impermanent nature of our physical experience, and so it's less weighty. Maybe that we're just being kinder to ourselves. Mindfulness and compassionate turning towards are a little like the mustard seed in the story of Kesa Gotami that Ratnavyuha was talking about last week. They just do their work over time. So for painful emotions, I feel like there's a softening that occurs and a little opening through this practice. I feel less closed off, more accepting of myself, even if the emotion hasn't really shifted at all. By just attending to it, it's somehow more okay. And I think, again, it's that my relationship to it has shifted. It can be there as part of my whole experience. There's no need to panic, no need for change. And I often feel a lot more open towards and accepting of others. But really overwhelming emotions are pretty tricky. And sometimes it can be hard to remember to be mindful in those circumstances. When I am able to catch myself and bring mindfulness in, maybe shift my attention into my body, into my feet, and just breathe again, something shifts. But I think with those overwhelming emotions, the fear of letting go and turning towards them can be much more intense. Again, we need to work with a feather, not a sledgehammer. And there is a place for distraction, I think. Just doing something you really enjoy. The difference is we do it with awareness of why we're doing it, not as an unconscious, habitual pushing away of something painful. And if you're practicing, you know the difference. And if you have judgments about what it is that you're enjoying, the only advice I can give is to just seriously really enjoy it regardless, as long as it's not causing serious harm to yourself or others. One evening, I realised I was sort of mindlessly scoffing my way through a pack of chocolate biscuits. You know, it's that one of like just sitting on the sofa, one in after the other. And it was a way of just avoiding some kind of painful emotions sitting by myself at night. So I slowed down and focused on really savouring the next biscuit. And it was fascinating. As soon as I did that, I felt kind of satisfied. And the need to eat the remainder of the pack abated. So yeah, so really savour and take in those pleasant distractions. You know, I might call that applying mindfulness to consciousness distraction. I don't know if we have another term for it. So there's something quite powerful that happens when we honour parts of our experience that we've been running from. I had a strong experience earlier this year of letting go into fear and anxiety in quite a physical way. Again, it was on a breathworks retreat because we were doing this little exercise in pairs. And the practice for one person was to sit on the floor in front of the other. So if I'm on the chair, someone sits down in front of me. And the instruction was just to for that person to lean back towards my legs, but to just hold enough tension that they weren't actually resting against me. And then the next instruction was to really let go into the person's legs and just notice what happened. And I was the person on the floor, and I was feeling a bit tired and fraught when we did this exercise, and I was just really tense anyway, so I couldn't have accidentally relaxed into their legs if I wanted to. But then, when we were asked to let go and relax, I didn't do it. And I was paired up with an order member in Melbourne called Amita Shraddha, who's also a breathworks teacher, and she was like, hey Marie, you know you haven't let go, right? And I said, yeah, I kind of feel if I do, I might burst into tears, and I don't want to do that in front of these people that I have to teach this afternoon. She was like, oh, okay. And then kind of for some reason, everybody got up and went off for a tea break. And so I was still sitting there, so I just let go. And Vijayamala looked over at me and just went, how did that feel? And my response was, I feel like a whole person again. So it's just a real sense of relief. I mean, I also felt quite vulnerable, but not really in a scary way. It was like I'd fragmented off parts of myself to get through the morning, and it wasn't good. And I didn't actually burst into tears. It was really just a physical relaxing and a sense of merging with something again. And I realised that I really needed some time out, but I hadn't been taking it. I'd just been trying to do too much for many reasons. Enthusiasm, wanting to help, but also fear of not doing enough or being perceived to not be doing enough, and fear of missing out. But by trying to push on to be fine, trying to just ignore my fears, and shutting down that part of me that was crying out for rest and space, I became unwhole. It wasn't until I physically let those things in again that I realised how unpleasant and in some ways kind of isolating that fractured experience had been. I really appreciated a talk someone gave on the women's GFR retreat a couple of years ago. She said that no one ever told her it was okay to go for a walk in the woods by herself. No one ever told me that either. So I spent years thinking something was wrong with me for always wanting to wander off by myself. So it's amazing the ways that judgment creeps in and we end up dishonouring and carving off little pieces of ourselves. Anyway, that experience I described of the exercise when I found I was unconsciously already holding on really tightly, that's a great example of physical cues to something that we're turning away from. So just checking in with your body on a regular basis can be a really helpful practice. Pay kind and genuine attention to signs of tension or resistance in the body and soften into them with the breath as much as you can. The other thing, though, is that we can't always let go, and it's best not to expect anything to change, because then you're really just grasping after another better experience again, turning away from what is. This is kind of tricky and paradoxical work. By gently leaning into and opening our hearts as best we can to emotional or physical pain, just as it is in the moment, things soften, our experience opens up. Then things might harden again in the course of seconds, days, months, years. Turning towards is the work of a lifetime. There's a Rumi poem called Bird Wings that says, if our hand were always a fist or always open, we would be paralysed. Your deepest experience is in every small contracting and expanding. So go gently and just keep practicing, but also abandon any hope of fruition. So it is a paradox. By wanting ourselves to be other than we are, we just get stuck in a cycle of aversion and grasping. By allowing ourselves to be as we are, something shifts. We don't practice as a means to an end. We just practice, and over time we go deeper and deeper. I like that idea of Michelangelo's, that every block of stone has a work of art inside it, and it is a sculptor, or the task of the sculptor, to discover it. So we just keep revealing the mystery. Our working ground lies in the discovery and awareness of the fullness of our experience. Vidyamala does talk about this idea of kind of fullness and wholeness in her first book, Living Well with Pain and Illness. I just wanted to read a couple of passages from that. So mindfulness and healing are both concerned with becoming more integrated and whole. Even if you can't be whole physically because of damage, surgery or disease, you can still experience a healthy and whole relationship between your body and your mind, between yourself and the world. These connections can even be sacred. The words healing, health, holy and wholeness all come from the same etymological root. Wholeness in this sense is the real key to happiness and inner peace. Wholeness is inclusive. If even the smallest part of you is excluded, then wholeness itself is fractured. If you exclude your pain and difficulties from your life by resisting them or expelling them into the cold of unawareness, you cannot be whole. You cannot heal or be happy in the deepest sense. But if you allow life in without resistance or clinging, you can be healthy and whole, no matter what kind of injury or disease process you may be living with. So if we're practicing mindfulness, and trying to develop positive emotion, we're inevitably going to be confronted not just by physically and emotionally painful moments, but by aspects of ourselves that we don't like. The parts that respond with irritation or anger instead of compassion or equanimity. The parts that respond with envy rather than sympathetic joy. The parts that hate, the parts that aren't robust and healthy. The parts that feel sad or vulnerable or scared. The practice of not turning away in those moments takes courage, patience, kindness, and a willingness to let go of judging ourselves. So before, when I talked about the experience of physically letting go and having a sense of becoming whole again, something I wanted to say was that there was a kind of beauty in the vulnerability that came with that. It didn't feel unsafe or scary or overwhelming. But there seems to be this fine line that I walk between accessing the beauty and spaciousness and kind of profundity, for what want of good words in a way, of feeling vulnerable and just feeling totally aversive to it. Before I went on the GFR retreat, an order member sent an email to the organisers requesting I have a small room with specific people because I had serious health issues. And she did this to help me out because I was really kind of worried about how I was going to manage on a two-week retreat. But I really just like had a big reaction to being described that way. And I rang a friend and said, you know, someone just described me as having serious health issues and I feel really uncomfortable about that. And his response was, well, yeah, I mean, you're not always like that, Marie, but when it's bad, it's pretty bad. And then another friend described me as a delicate little petal. It's funny because I was thinking, you know, how do I think of myself? And it's like, I'm fine. That's kind of all that came to mind. But, you know, that kind of association makes me feel incredibly vulnerable on so many levels. And my default response is to feel frightened and really to feel aversion towards myself for being vulnerable, because I have these negative assumptions of what that means about me and about my life, many of which are probably not true. So if I can drop the judgment and the fear, vulnerability has an expansive, open quality. With the judgment and fear, it's contracting, isolating, and sometimes feels almost a bit unbearable. So a more subtle example of discovering parts of ourselves we don't like is maybe we get home from work and we're tired and feeling a little irritated and we want a nice quiet night and a friend calls to talk about their troubles. And I'm not talking about major crises, more the, and then the carpet layer came late and the colour was wrong type of stuff. And honestly, sometimes my initial reaction is just like, oh God, you know, I really don't want to be listening to this. I've got my own problems. I want some me time. And I'm actually like feeling kind of angry at them for infringing on my time and space. But if I try to pretend I'm feeling something else, what usually happens is if I withdraw and they sense it and get upset or confused. I can also get more resentful and angry with them the longer they talk, but also feel kind of increasingly disappointed with myself for not being able to be more open and generous with them. Things go so much better when I acknowledge that I'm tired and irritated and let them know without blaming them for it. They might be disappointed at not having an eager ear to bend, and I might be disappointed too that I can't respond to them as either of us would like. But it's often much more possible to keep the lines of communication open and find a way through without confusion or blame. But we have to be willing to acknowledge what's really going on for us, and for that to be painful sometimes, because there's a gap between our spiritual ideals and how we actually feel. Learning to be with ourselves with kindness in those moments, without falling into the trap of self-judgment and self-criticism, brings about a softening and an opening of our hearts. And we are acting in alignment with our values. We're being kind, generous, and truthful with ourselves. Charity begins at home, as the saying goes. So we can't truthfully develop compassion towards others if we can't develop compassion towards ourselves. And it's possible that that might sound a little bit selfish or a little bit like a cop-out to some of you. But sometimes we have to work at the level of aspiration because we just haven't developed enough positive emotion to spontaneously respond in the way we might like. With aspiration, we're not trying to hide our true feelings or convince ourselves to believe something we don't really believe. Pema Chodron says in her book, The Places That Scare You, with aspiration, we are expressing our willingness to open our hearts and move closer to our fears. So don't use those moments when your internal experience doesn't meet your ideals as ammunition against yourself. Sometimes all we can do in those moments is breathe with our anger or sadness, fatigue, irritation or disappointment, and try to be kind to ourselves. This is a moment of suffering. And sometimes it's difficult to even contact kindness, but here we work with aspiration. It can be enough to hold an intention of being kind to yourself rather than responding with harshness or aversion. Setting the intention does have a powerful effect itself. Our habit is to turn away, so explicitly holding the heart wish, or even just the thought to be kind to yourself, and perhaps to those around you, can undercut those habitual reactions. So slowly we adjust our course, become more whole, and align our responses more with our values. If you value the precepts of kindness and generosity, be kind and generous with yourself in the moments when you realise you feel less than kind and generous. Then pay attention to what happens. If I feel really stuck in those moments, I might imagine being bathed in the red light of the Buddha Amitabha's love and compassion. And that can be really helpful when I can't seem to do the work myself. The Buddhist tradition is rich with mythic figures and symbols, so you can play with them and use anyone that speaks to you. Again, it's working at an aspirational level. In the Triratna system of meditation, the first stage of deepening our practice is integration, where we cultivate a full experience of ourselves and a responsibility for ourselves as moral agents in the world. The second stage is the development of positive emotion, being loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Now, the stages are not really linear. We all start by practicing both the mindfulness of breathing to cultivate awareness and the metta bhavana to cultivate loving kindness. So they sort of dance with each other in some respects. But it's not really possible to develop emotion without being willing to meet ourselves. Sorry, to develop positive emotion, we can develop all sorts of emotions otherwise, without being willing to meet ourselves with awareness as we are, to experience ourselves fully, and to recognise the impact of our actions and choices. At another Monday night talk earlier this year, a young man asked Ratna Vyuha what was the best thing he could do to speed up his progress on the spiritual path. And Ratna Vyuha answered in what may have seemed a rather unexpected way. He kind of laughed and said something like, "I think it's important to be really honest about where you're at." And then went on to give an example from his own life about his dependence on coffee. And that's really stuck with me because I was surprised by the answer at that time too. But we have to start where we are. Using spiritual practice and ideals to deny our desires, our actual thoughts and feelings, is just another form of running away. Those painful places we keep trying to drown out are the source of our awakening. I really wanted to include this Billy Collins poem called Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. Because I think it speaks to the futility of running away and also the gift of these barking dogs within us. The neighbour's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high, rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbour's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast But I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for Barking Dog. And when the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous Barking Dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. I might leave you to dwell on that one, but I will just end with a little story from Pema Chodron again that Erica introduced me to last Friday. There is a story of a woman running away from tigers. She runs and runs, and the tigers are getting closer and closer. When she comes to the edge of a cliff, she sees some vines there, so she climbs down and holds onto the vines. Looking down, she sees that there are tigers below her as well. She then notices that a mouse is gnawing away at the vine to which she is clinging. She also sees a beautiful little bunch of strawberries close to her growing out of a clump of grass. She looks up and she looks down. She looks at the mouse. Then she just takes the strawberry, puts it in her mouth, and enjoys it thoroughly. Tigers above, tigers below. This is actually the predicament we are always in terms of our birth and death. Each moment is just what it is. It might be the only moment of our life. It might be the only strawberry we ever eat. We could get depressed about it, or we could finally appreciate it and delight in the preciousness of every single moment of our life.